From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Many music industry people are in Austin, Texas now, looking for emerging talent at the South by Southwest Music Conference, which showcases new bands. On today's Fresh Air, we meet one of the performers spotlighted there this year, Alejandro Escovedo, and we'll hear songs from his new album, 13 Years. Also today, the expectations and stereotypes of the coach's wife. Terry Phelps is married to Digger Phelps, the former longtime basketball coach at Notre Dame. She's written a memoir about how she created an identity for herself beyond the coach's wife. And TV critic David Bianculli has a preview of The Birds 2, a sequel to the Hitchcock classic. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Another group of White House officials are expected to appear today before a federal grand jury in Washington. It's probing the Whitewater affair. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Departing White House counsel Bernard Nussbaum was the first to testify today before the grand jury. Nussbaum announced his resignation a few weeks ago after being criticized for a number of Whitewater-related missteps. All told, 10 current or former administration officials have been subpoenaed by independent counsel Robert Fisk. In this part of his investigation, Fisk is looking into a series of meetings between officials of the administration and the Treasury Department, which is overseeing the investigation of the failure of an Arkansas savings and loan with ties to the Clinton. Fisk is trying to determine whether any of the contacts were improper. Last week, three administration officials testified: First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton's chief of staff, press secretary, and the White House director of communications. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
The House Judiciary Committee has voted 27-8 in favor of a three strikes and you're out bill. The measure would impose life sentences on any federal prisoner who has committed three crimes, at least two of which were violent. One of the crimes could be a serious drug felony, but the crime that draws the life sentence would have to be a violent crime. The committee also adopted an amendment that would allow federal prisons to free some elderly three-strikes prisoners, but they would have to be 70 years old, have served 30 years of their sentence, and pose no threat to society. Irish Prime Minister Albert Reynolds is in the United States meeting with Clinton administration officials. He and President Clinton observed St. Patrick's Day in a special ceremony. Reynolds says the Irish are trying to resolve conflicts in Northern Ireland peacefully.
We in Ireland know from direct experience that conflicts over territory, identity, and political destiny can only be resolved through peaceful negotiations. That profound belief informs everything that my government and I are doing to resolve the problem of Northern Ireland.
Reynolds signed an agreement on peace in Northern Ireland with his British counterpart, John Major, on December 15th. Sinn Féin, the political wing of the IRA, is asking the British government to clarify the peace declaration. Two Israeli soldiers say they fired at a West Bank mosque during a gunman's attack on worshippers last month. The Muslims were trying to flee a Jewish settler who opened fire on them. One soldier told Israeli investigators guards thought Arabs were shooting inside. The soldier says he and another guard shot at the door to prevent anyone from shooting at them. Their testimony contradicts top army officers who say soldiers fired into the air. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 16 points at 3,864. The Nasdaq is up 4.5 at 803. This is NPR. The Bosnian government and Bosnian Serbs have signed an agreement that will be a step toward lifting the two-year-old siege of Sarajevo. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Although Sarajevo has enjoyed a month-long ceasefire that has put an end to daily shelling, citizens are still trapped in the city, which is surrounded by Serbian troops. Now the warring parties have signed a carefully negotiated agreement that will open several key roads out of the city to civilian traffic. One of the routes to be opened leads to Muslim-controlled central Bosnia, and others connect Sarajevo to some of its suburbs controlled by the Serbs. After the agreement goes into effect next week, civilians wishing to make trips from Sarajevo will have to notify the United Nations 24 hours in advance, because the UN will control the routes and provide escorts. Although the plan falls far short of providing free access into and out of the city, the UN calls the agreement a very important first step toward lifting the siege of Sarajevo. I'm Andy Bowers in London.
A federal judge says that Occidental Chemical Corporation doesn't owe New York State any punitive damages for the contamination of Love Canal. The Niagara Falls neighborhood had to be evacuated because of the pollution. U.S. District Judge John Curtin has rejected New York's claim that Occidental should pay up to $250 million in penalties. Curtin also said state prosecutors did not prove the chemical firm showed a reckless disregard for safety when it dumped chemicals at Love Canal in the 40s and 50s. Occidental is still liable under federal Superfund law for part of the cleanup costs. Philadelphia authorities say they think they've crippled mob operations in the region with a sweeping indictment, but the FBI says it hasn't broken organized crime in the region. One top agent says he just expects organized crime to rebuild. Reputed organized crime boss John Stanfa, his attorney, and 22 other people have been charged with crimes ranging from murder to arson. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The South by Southwest Music Conference is underway in Austin, Texas. It's a showcase for new bands from around the country that attracts record industry people looking for emerging talent. My guest Alejandro Escovedo was one of the hits of last year's festival and has several performances coming up this year. Last night, he was named Songwriter of the Year at the Austin Music Awards. Escovedo is a singer, songwriter, and guitarist with a new album called 13 Years. It's the second album under his own name, but he's been performing for close to 20 years in different settings, like the punk band The Nuns, the cowboy rock band Rank and File, and the rock band True Believers. Let's open with the song The Ballad of the Sun and the Moon from Alejandro Escovedo's new album, 13 Years.
Can you hear the cannon and the fighting? Can you feel the soldiers when they're marching? They came, they took my sister away. They came and they took her away. That's the ballad of the sun.
Alejandro Escovedo, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
The Ballad of the Sun and the Moon that we've been listening to, what inspired the song and what is it about to you?
The song was inspired by stories that my father told me. My father was born in Saltillo, Mexico, which is in northern Mexico. And he just used to tell us a lot of stories about growing up in the mountains and about, actually part of it is about Pancho Villa's troops coming through and taking the young women having to be hidden from the soldiers. And so I just really tried to capture the feel of the mountains, and a lot of that was inspired by driving through the West Texas area, you know, in between Austin and El Paso, actually.
There's a line in that song, they came and took my sister away.
Right.
Was there somebody in the family who was taken?
No, I just kind of threw that in there.
Right. Okay. let me play another song by you. It's actually the title song from your new album, 13 Years. Okay. Is there a story behind this song?
Yeah. 13 Years was a song I wrote for Bobby. It was a...
She was your wife.
Right. It came at a time when we had been together for 13 years and lived in San Francisco and New York and then Austin. My career was pretty... things were pretty quiet. No one was really calling me up on the phone or anything. And she had, you know, stood behind me all that time and... I tried to write it from her perspective, a woman who's lived with a musician for 13 years and really kind of just questions whether it was all worth it. And, you know, there's times when really the only thing you have to offer is a song, so that was it for me, and that's why I wrote this for her.
So this was your attempt to see your relationship from her point of view?
Yeah, in a way. I mean, yeah, I guess it was.
D- Did you see it differently after trying that?
Well, I mean, I always understood how hard it was, you know, and I don't know, a woman who lives with a musician is sometimes looked upon as just merely an extension of, you know, the man's personality or whatever, you know. You're Alejandro's girlfriend or you're Alejandro's wife instead of being Bobby, you know. So I think that always really bothered her, and I don't know, I just wanted to write this song for her.
Mm-hmm. It's a great song. Let's hear it. It's 13 Years, the title song from Alejandro Escovedo's new album.
13 years I followed you. What do I have that isn't blue? A thousand promises fall on me. You know the end of it I can't see. From San Francisco to New York, all I seem to do is work. My feet hurt and it's not from dancing close to you.
For many years, you performed other people's songs, and now you're performing your own. And some of the songs, like the one we just heard, are really very personal. It must have completely changed the act of performing for you, because you're performing material that's very close to you.
It changed it dramatically. I don't find it difficult to write the songs because, in fact, I find it very easy to write in that style. A personal, you know, to write personal songs, but there was times when I would get very, and I still do, get very self-conscious about performing these songs in front of people who are basically there to drink and, you know, enjoy the nightlife or whatever, and there's some guy just really kind of bleeding on stage. It doesn't always mix well.
Let me play another song from your album. This is called Tell Me Why. Can you tell us what the song is about?
Well, once again, this is a song about you know, it's a combination of things. It's a song that was actually written before my wife died, and I finished it after she had died. And so during the time that we were separated, I was very distraught and really not sure of what was going on. I was very confused, and afterwards it's just kind of like, you know, I found that there's never an answer to these questions as to why, you know, she did that and why it happened. So that's what it's about.
Your wife took her own life.
Right.
So you had been separated before?
Yeah.
Before that?
Right. I was living in my own apartment for a while.
Well, let's hear the song. This is called Tell Me Why.
Tell me why you had to walk away. You never stopped to say goodbye. Tell me why time changes everything. And then we're left to sing alone. I don't know what to do. I just wish I could see your face and they say that time heals all. I don't believe them. I don't believe them.
I think there's a fair number of your fans, and certainly of music critics, who know that your wife had committed suicide. And there's a temptation, I think, to hear that in many of your songs, to hear the new album as being largely about that and about that period of your life. Would it be fair to hear the album in that way, or just does it bother you when people hear it in that context?
Well, I think it's partly correct, but I think a lot of it is that, you know, a lot of those songs, like you say, everyone associates those songs, I mean, Gravity and 13 Years, with her death. A lot of the songs were written before Bobby died. A lot of them have to do with the woman that I'm now married to, you know. I think 13 Years is kind of like, a friend of mine last night, as a matter of fact, came up to me and said he finally understood what the album was about, because you kind of see this kind of like journey from her death and working through that to She Towers Above, which is a song I wrote for Dana, you know, who is now my wife.
Mm-hmm.
I just got married 2 days ago.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
Oh, that's very nice.
Yeah. So I'm very happy. I mean, you know, my life has changed a lot, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's
my children and my home.
Well, it must be kind of paradoxical for you in a way to have this album, which does have some songs of mourning on it, come out at a time that coincides with a celebration in your life,
right,
a wedding.
Right.
So in some ways, I guess it's almost a little out of sync, but maybe that's good, because it's probably maybe a little easier to sing certain songs when you have a little bit of emotional distance on it.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. There are certain songs that I just don't do every performance, because they require a certain kind of state that I'm not always in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided not to try to play those songs every night, you know. So it is kind of strange, because I am very, very happy at this point, and yet my music doesn't necessarily reflect that, you know.
My guest is Alejandro Escovedo. His new album is called 13 Years. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Austin-based singer-songwriter Alejandro Escovedo. Let me ask you a little bit about your background. You're Mexican-American. You were born in San Antonio, grew up in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of neighborhood did you grow up in?
Well, in San Antonio, we lived pretty much out in the country, you know. We lived, we didn't have many neighbors out there. And when we moved to California, we first moved to Orange, California. That was like 57. So it was still pretty much orange groves and avocado orchards, and the trains were still running through and everything. There were still hobos around, and it was kind of still a very rural atmosphere until I moved to Huntington Beach, which was kind of just a beach town, you know. But I didn't really grow up in the barrio, if that's what you're asking me.
Mm-hmm. What kind of work did your parents do?
My father has done, you know, my father's 87 now.
Hmm.
So when he moved from Saltillo, he was very young. I think he was about 12 years old, and he was, you know, doing migrant work and ended up doing all sorts of things. He was a singer in a mariachi band. He played semi-pro ball. He was a prize fighter. He worked on ships, the shipyards in Northern California. He ended up being a plumber, and my mother was raised us, you know, all her life. And she's still alive. They live in Southern California, in Chula Vista.
Did a lot of people assume that since you were Chicano that you should like either Mexican music or salsa and not gravitate toward rock or punk rock?
Uh-huh. Yes, I get a little of that, but not as much. there are, especially here in Texas, there's a lot of Chicano kids who love rock and roll, and San Antonio especially is a hotbed and one of the centers for, you know, heavy metal. I mean, you know, it's a real working class kind of thing. And I don't know, it's funny, you know, growing up with my friends who did live in the Vado, I remember that all the guys who were kind of lowriders, you know, we all listened to, you know, we listened to the Midnighters, we listened to the Temptations, the Four Tops, but also bands like The Doors and Creedence Clearwater were very, very popular, you know. And, you know, you'd find those eight tracks in you know, not only in the guys who were surfers, but also in the lowriders, too. So there's a lot of cross-cultural thing that happens in Southern California, especially, you know.
I believe your brother, one of your brothers, Pete, played in Santana's band?
Both my brother Pete and Coke played with Santana, and then they went on to form their own band. Originally, they had a band called the Escovedo Brothers, which was a Latin jazz, kind of like a Cal Jader-type band.
Mm-hmm.
Then Santana. Then they had their band called Azteca. And now they've gone on to play with, you know, Pete has gone on to play with all sorts of famous musicians, you know, from Willie Bobo, Tito Puente, Cal Jader, all sorts of people.
Mm-hmm. I want to play another song of yours, and this is a song from your previous album, Gravity, and the song is called Broken Bottle. Would you say something about this song?
This is a song I wrote about a man who's involved in a relationship but has fallen in love with another woman, and this is just kind of a song of love, but he's finding it hard to express it.
Is this song about you?
Mm-hmm.
Let's hear it. This is Broken Bottle.
If I could reveal what I feel for you, mark my words with a gentle kiss, like St. George, I'd slay the dragon just to find I'd lost. From outside this window, there's walls between us. Outside is outside, and that's where I'll be. I'll be wrapped in the morning dew, just to find you've gone. So pour me a drink from a broken bottle. Fill my glass with the dirty water. What I've lost is gone, what I've gained has no name. I'll take my leave once more.
When did you write the song?
Oh, see, I wrote it as I was, as Bobby and I were splitting up, actually. We had been having a hard time, you know, a very difficult time. We were definitely starting to see things very differently. And I wrote it then.
When your wife, Bobby, committed suicide, you had already broken up. And in trying to imagine what that period was like for you, I find myself wondering if you went through a period of feeling really guilty, like somehow maybe the breakup had something to do with it.
You know, that's the most difficult thing that I live with. It's, I don't know, you understand, you know, I can intellectualize that a person makes their final decisions, and that ultimately it's the responsibility of the individual, but at the same time you can't help thinking that your involvement in that person's life didn't affect them in a way that maybe wasn't positive. You know, it's like when you live with someone for, you know, almost 15 years, there's no way that, you know, I just know that that our lives were too caught up in each other not to have some sort of effect.
Have you written a song about that feeling yet?
No, I haven't. I haven't.
Would that be too hard to write about?
I don't. You know, I think it might be really good for me to kind of like try to express it, because it is a very strange thing. Guilt is something that really can, you know, just kind of eat you away, you know. You know, the thing about it is that you don't know, there's no answer. There's no, you know, complete answer to this question, you know. There's no sorting out, like, you know, why this happened, you know. There's all sorts of elements. I'm sure her life, you know, had to have had something to do with it. You know, her relationship with not only me, but her parents and, you know, all those things that affect you and kind of mold your personality, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if that's a cop-out or, you know. I mean, I'm not trying to take the blame away from myself, but I don't, you know, I certainly don't want to think that I'm the sole responsibility for that, you know. Does that make...
Yeah.
If that makes any sense, I don't know.
Yeah. You're in Austin now. We're speaking to you from Austin.
Right.
And this is the weekend of the South by Southwest Music Festival. And you'll be performing there. And I'm wondering what kind of songs you're going to be performing. I know you're performing several concerts in different contexts.
Yeah.
And are you going to choose your songs according to the mood of the occasion and play more rockin' things one night and more personal things another?
Well, I'm playing with three different groups. So I'm playing with the Setters, which is a group consisting of Michael Hall and Walter Sauce Humara from the Silos and myself. And the True Believers reunion is definitely dictated by loud guitars and, you know, the rock and roll feel. And then my performance on Sunday is my orchestra, which plays only once a year, really, you know. So that's where I have three strings, three horns, two drummers, electric guitar, bass, and myself, and a pedal steel guitar player.
What does your orchestra perform only once a year?
Well, there's just too many people. It's a logistical nightmare, and it's a beautiful sound, though. I love it, but there's no way that I could take it out on the road or really, you know, get that many people together for any sort of schedule.
It must be expensive to do that, too.
It's very expensive, very expensive. But it's really worth it, because the sound is just wonderful.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Alejandro Escovedo's new album is called 13 Years. It's on Watermelon Records. Ryko Disc just reissued the music of his earlier band, True Believers. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's more from 13 Years.
Down. The unexpected is my best friend, so won't you tell me, is this really the end? Everybody's screaming, just get the last word. The difference is what you said and what I heard. Why do all hearts break instead of bend? You gotta tell me straight, is this really the end? Is this really the end?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. For 25 years, Terry Phelps was a coach's wife. For most of those years, her husband, Digger Phelps, was the basketball coach at Notre Dame. Coming up, we talk about her new memoir, in which she describes the privileges and frustrations that came with her position and the challenges of creating an identity that went beyond the coach's wife. Also, TV critic David Bianculli has a preview of The Birds 2, Showtime's sequel to the Hitchcock classic. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton has helped kick off an anti-violence campaign. At the unveiling of several public service announcements, the president said it was time to give children back their childhood. He also noted that Alicia Brown, the 14-year-old Washington, D.C. girl who appears with him in the ads, left the White House ceremony to attend the funeral of a sixth friend who had been murdered.
While the rest of us have pursued our dreams in life, had our families, raised our children, enjoyed the fruits of freedom, that is what has become of childhood. It is indecent. It is unacceptable. We can do something about it.
A California judge has blocked the release of a serial rapist who was to be paroled. Melvin Carter was convicted of being the college terrorist rapist who stalked campuses in Northern California. Prosecutors say he confessed to as many as 100 rapes. Modoc County officials say they were notified last night that Carter would be released in the rural town of Alturas in the northeastern part of the state. They asked for and received a temporary restraining order. Carter is still in custody pending an April 1st hearing. The Alturas police chief says if Carter is released in the town, he won't live long. It's packing day aboard the space shuttle Columbia. Astronauts are stowing away their gear in preparation for a landing tomorrow in Florida. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
Tomorrow's touchdown at the Kennedy Space Center will signal the end of NASA's second-longest shuttle mission. However, the crew has hopes of breaking that record. If the shuttle is postponed by just one orbit, which amounts to a 90-minute delay, Columbia's crew will set a new endurance record. Only bad weather or a technical problem with the shuttle would cause a delay, and neither is projected to be a concern. Endurance by the crew was a major area of research during this mission. What's left of today's activities will concentrate on the effects of near-weightlessness on the crew. The shuttle was also put through several roll maneuvers today that studied how gases collide with the shuttle, creating a glow. That glow can interfere with telescopic observations. Other experiments have been packed away for tomorrow's landing, now scheduled for 8:09 Eastern Time. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
The Justice Department says six major airlines have agreed to settle price-fixing charges. They'd been accused of using a central ticket system to raise fares by nearly $2 billion. The airlines have agreed to start up a new fare system that will bar them from offering new fares available only at a future date. The Justice Department says once a fare is posted in the centralized computer system, the airlines must immediately start selling tickets at that price. On Wall Street, stocks closed up today. The Dow gained 17 points to end at 3,865. This is NPR. A published report suggests that American Airlines' parent company will post a larger-than-expected loss for the first quarter of this year. The Dallas Morning News says American's pilots heard this word during a meeting with AMR Chairman Robert Crandall. One pilot says the expected loss is $100 million or more. That's twice as bad as some analysts have predicted. General Motors workers in Dayton, Ohio, have ratified a tentative agreement ending a strike. The walkout at the brake-making plants had forced other General Motors plants to shut down when they ran out of parts. Russia's defense minister said today that Russia will be ready to enter into a partnership with NATO by the end of this month. Brooke Gladstone reports from Moscow.
After meeting with U.S. Defense Secretary William Perry, Russian Defense Minister Pavel Grachev said that Russia is almost ready to join NATO's Partnership for Peace and will soon announce its conditions for participation. NATO said it welcomed that participation, but debate in Russia's lower house of parliament was not unanimous today. Vladimir Lukin, a former ambassador to the U.S., likened the whole NATO Partnership for Peace arrangement to rape, whereupon another lawmaker said that Russia risked self-isolation if it refused to join. Up to now, 12 nations have joined the Partnership for Peace, which will involve joint exercises and military planning. It was originally offered as a compromise to the nations of Eastern Europe, such as Poland, which had sought full participation in NATO. But Russia has opposed full membership for its neighbors. This is Brooke Gladstone in Moscow.
There have been reports of violence today in the occupied territories. A shootout between Palestinians and Israeli soldiers in Gaza left two Palestinians dead. The Israeli army says the Palestinians fired first. In Gaza and the West Bank, there were demonstrations, and Palestinians threw stones at soldiers. Soldiers fired back. Arab reports say at least 14 Palestinians have been wounded. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. For 25 years, Terry Phelps's life was structured around the basketball season. For about 20 of those years, her husband, Digger Phelps, was the basketball coach at Notre Dame. Terry Phelps says coaches' wives are expected to attend all the games, smile all the time, cheer the team on, even bake for them. But she was determined to be more than the stereotype of the coach's wife. Shortly after arriving at Notre Dame, she became one of the university's first female students. After graduate school, she joined the law faculty, where she's now a tenured professor. She's written a new memoir called The Coach's Wife. She says that even though the coach's wife has a lot of duties she's expected to perform, she's always an outsider. That became apparent to her on the day of her husband's first press conference at Notre Dame.
So we arrived in town. My husband had just had a fantastically successful year at Fordham University, and he was hot property. And he was offered the head coaching job at University of Notre Dame. So we went out there. Before we went, I bought a new blue and gold dress, the blue and gold are Notre Dame's colors, thinking, well, I'm going to be at his side at the press conference. All these images of women at men's sides that I had seen through my childhood and adolescence. And I arrived at breakfast. The first day we were on campus, I discovered that I had been set up with a real estate woman to look at houses during the day, and that I was not expected, in fact, not permitted to go to the press conference. Women didn't go to press conferences about men getting coaching jobs. That was a male domain. That was male space. So off I went to look for houses. I remember being disappointed, but certainly not the kind of person then who could speak up and say, I don't care, I'm going to the press conference.
Your book, which is a memoir, actually started out more as a survey of what the wives of athletes and coaches experienced. And you decided to make the book more personal. But you did a lot of those surveys, and you got a lot of responses back. What were some of the problems that women had in common?
All coaches' wives that I surveyed spoke about the lack of privacy that they felt in their lives because of their husbands' jobs, the intense pressure all the time. Your destiny seems so hinged on whether a team won or lost. Problems making friends, not knowing who real friends were because people attach themselves to coaches and to athletic teams as long as they're successful, and sometimes these people disappear when the team starts to lose. Little time with your husband, and the husband having little time with a wife or with his family. Those four things in particular, I'd say.
When you got married, you write, you took your husband's name, you took his identity, even his religion, you converted from Protestant to Catholic.
Right.
But pretty early on after you got to Notre Dame, you started carving out your own identity. The year that Notre Dame was open to women, in 1972, you went back to school, and then you ended up teaching literature and writing at the Notre Dame Law School. What was the public reaction when you decided to go to college at Notre Dame and then eventually started teaching there?
People in the community and at Notre Dame were shocked that I had stepped outside of my prescribed role as a coach's wife. I didn't hear too much of it directly, but we heard rumor after rumor after rumor about how Terry's gone back to school, so Digger has to take the children to the office, or he has to do the grocery shopping. And then people in a town such as South Bend, a place such as Notre Dame, they begin to attribute the team's success to, or lack of success, to the fact that I wasn't being supportive enough.
Was your husband supportive of you going back to school?
He was supportive. He was threatened by it, to be sure, and we struggled. He was raised in a very traditional family. He expected, although he never articulated this, he expected he'd have a wife a lot like his mother, who was at home all the time for him. And it was not easy at all. But at no time did he say, I don't want you to do this. And as it progressed and he saw how much it meant to me and I was good at it and it was right for me to be doing it, he became very supportive.
Do you like basketball, and how much did you enjoy all the games that you went to over the years?
I liked it in the beginning. I think that may have been part of our relationship, that I enjoyed, when we were dating, I enjoyed going to games with my soon-to-be husband. But as I became more involved in it, when it became a job and that you couldn't afford to lose or there would be nasty letters in the paper about your husband, the fun went out of it entirely for me, and I began to dislike it entirely.
Did you start to dislike the fans because if things were going well, they'd be great, they'd be there for you, but if things weren't going well, there'd be booze for your husband?
Yes, indeed. It is extremely painful to stand in a packed arena and listen to people booing your husband. And what are the choices? Do I not go to the games? And the one person who should be there for him isn't. Or do I go, as I tried to most of the time, and just stand there listening and trying to smile through it and trying to pretend that everything is all right? It's very difficult and very painful.
During a tough game when things weren't going well and there were boos for the team or for your husband, would you be able to tell if the camera was on you?
I tried to hide from the cameras. If people asked, if producers came and asked where I was sitting, I asked people not to tell them because I felt that was a terrible invasion of privacy. And you do see this all the time now in big games, that the camera will go to the wife in the final seconds of a very close and very important game. And her face shows incredible anguish. And I felt that that was an invasion of privacy. And I think that it is. I think the wives should be left alone. Unless they explicitly say, I enjoy this and sure, put the camera on me, that they should be left alone.
Terry Phelps is my guest. Her new memoir, The Coach's Wife, is about the years her husband, Digger Phelps, was the coach of basketball at Notre Dame. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Terry Phelps, author of the memoir, The Coach's Wife. College basketball changed a lot in the 25 years that your husband coached. And recruiting practices changed. The whole idea of the student-athlete started to change. In 1982, your husband spoke out about recruiting practices. And in your book, you write about what you call the hidden obstacles of recruiting at Notre Dame. What were some of those obstacles you're talking about?
Well, at Notre Dame in particular, recruiting for basketball is tricky business because it is seen by high school athletes as a football school. So first of all, you're dealing with young men with huge egos who want to be the most important people on campus when they go to school, perhaps not willing to go to a place where they're going to be playing for the secondary sport. Notre Dame also has tough academic requirements. Notre Dame requires 3 years of high school math to get in. Now, that may not sound like a huge requirement to most people, but of the top 100 recruits in high school this year for basketball, a safe bet would be that 85 of them do not have 3 years of high school math. Other schools require 3 years of high school math to get in their universities if you're a regular student, but they waive the requirement for athletes. And Notre Dame did not do that. Now, I have no problems with these academic requirements. The only problem I have is when people forget that there are those requirements and expect the coach to win at the same level as teams that completely waive all kinds of academic requirements for the athletes.
Because if you have these rigorous standards, it puts you at a competitive disadvantage when it comes to recruiting.
It does. Once in a while, a Bill Bradley and a Princeton will go to the Final Four. But teams like that appear once or twice in a decade. They're not going to have 25-game winning seasons every single year. And fans don't seem to be willing to accept that. Fans want it both ways. I suspect that wanting it both ways and two very conflicting things, big-time sports winning all the time and yet good academic, high academic standards, are the pressures that are making coaches act a little bit crazy this year.
As NCAA regulations became more complicated, regulations defining the relationship between a coach and the recruits and a coach and the team, how did that change the relationship that you and your husband had to the players, the recruits, and their parents?
The rules got so complicated. The rules all arose from situations that needed some kind of control, but then typical lawmaking, that the law covers or the rule covers much more than that it's intended to. For example, as to how you could entertain the players or entertain the players' parents came into force. So you couldn't, if we made friends with the players' parents and went out to have pizza after a game, we would have to be absolutely certain that they paid for their exact portion of the bill. We were in danger even if we split the bill for fear that we had paid for a little bit of their portion, and that would be a technical violation of an NCAA rule. One story I tell in the book is when one of our star players, David Rivers, was hurt and badly hurt in an automobile accident. And David came from a big family in Jersey City, New Jersey, and they did not have very much money. And my husband had to call them in the middle of the night to tell them of David's accident, and they had to drive from Jersey City to Indiana to see David in the hospital, because I just didn't have money for plane tickets, and we weren't allowed. We, the university, or we personally would have probably done it, but that is not allowed, or was at least at that time not allowed under the NCAA rules.
In 1991, your husband, Digger Phelps, was asked by the new administration at Notre Dame to resign. They were unhappy with his record?
I'm not sure. It's a bit mysterious to me, even now, exactly what they didn't like about his coaching or about the way he was handling the program. What they said was he wasn't winning enough. They didn't like his style of play. He had graduated 100% of the athletes who had played for him in 20 years. So they had nothing bad to say about that, the academic side of it. And also, he had won an average of 20 or more games every year and had gone to 14 NCAA tournaments. So it was a bit odd and shocking and surprising, as I relate in the book, that I was shocked when it happened. I never thought for a moment that he would be asked to leave as coach. And it was a difficult year for us to get through that and to try to, my struggle, to try and understand what was happening and why was this place that I cared for so much and had come to believe in, that had values and talked about family and indeed had a family kind of atmosphere, why suddenly we were outside the family in some significant way.
You reprint a memo in your book that was sent to your husband by the administration, basically offering him the chance to resign, but letting him know if he didn't resign that they would just release him. And then you had to decide whether he should resign or not, or let himself get fired. And he decided to go the resignation route and, in fact, to not let on publicly what was happening behind the scenes. What kind of talks did you have about this, privately, you and your husband, about how to handle this and which way to go?
During that year, when the university first told him that he would be coaching for his last year the next year, I wanted him to fight it, and I think he thought that way at first. I thought there's no way that they can do this. The public The public relations aspect of it would be too bad. I wanted him to confront them and go head to head. I'm a fighter, and I talk in the book about being a fighter pilot's daughter and having that kind of notion of fighting things and going down and burning planes. But through the year, I saw what the situation was doing to him, that he was beaten down by it. All kinds of decision-making was taken out of his hands. The scheduling had been taken out of his hands for a couple of years. They wanted to take recruiting decisions out of his hands. And those are crucial areas that a coach needs to have control over. And he was getting beaten down by it. And the part of him that believed that his team could beat anyone, the kind of boyish exuberance about the game, was beginning to diminish. And when I began to see that, I began to realize that maybe fighting this was not the right thing to do. He came to that decision himself. And he left without a single moment of bitterness about Notre Dame itself. I think he felt disappointed and certainly pained by the way that the administration had treated him. But his love for Notre Dame never faltered for a moment.
How has your life and also your personal sense of identity changed now that you no longer have to play the role of coach's wife?
It's a great relief. I can wake up mornings in the winter during basketball season. I have no knots in my stomach because a big game is coming up. Life is much, much calmer, and there is no pressure. And I am much happier. And I think my husband is, too. He is experiencing what it is like. He coached the whole time we were married. That's all we knew. And now we have a lot more time together and a lot less pressure in our lives. There seems to be a better quality to our lives.
He probably misses the game a lot, though.
Well, he still is involved as a color commentator for ESPN. So now he gets to coach all the teams and have all the players. And he's loving that. He's liking it a lot more than he anticipated. There are some things about coaching that he misses. He loved the strategy. He loved working with the kids. But there are other aspects to coaching, like the pressure, like the constant demands, the unspoken demands to sacrifice academics for winning, that he doesn't miss at all. And that aren't worked out in college sports, aren't solved for coaches. And that will happen, I think, in the next 10 years. But he doesn't miss that part of it at all.
Thank you very much
for
talking with us.
I've enjoyed it.
Terry Phelps' new memoir is called The Coach's Wife. This is Fresh Air. The UN has made a deal to partially lift the blockade of Sarajevo. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on that on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. I'll talk with reporter Kurt Schork in Sarajevo about the agreement. It opens Sarajevo in a very small and tightly controlled way. It goes into effect next week. It remains to be seen how truly effective it might become. Also, Robert Siegel talks about the new SAT test for college admission, a new style of testing, but the test results don't seem to be changing. Michael Scholar reports from South Africa on Nelson Mandela's campaign visit to Soweto. And I'll talk with Brendan Mulvihill and Donna Long about Irish music for violin and piano.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Thirty-one years ago, Alfred Hitchcock took a Daphne du Maurier short story and adapted it into the horror movie classic The Birds. This Saturday night, the Showtime cable network presents a telemovie sequel called The Birds 2, Land's End. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
Been gathering south of the island, haven't they?
When the tide rolled in last night, so did the birds. I could see them from the tower. Just waiting.
Waiting for what?
Just gathering, assembling, waiting like an army.
Make it sound like it's going to be war.
It's not as if we haven't asked for one. You know, Mother Nature can take only so much before she hits back with all she's got. Did you know something like this happened before?
When, recently?
25, 30 years ago?
Yeah, we knew. Just like we knew sooner or later that someone would have the bird-brained idea to make a sequel. Aliens 3, Jaws 2. Sequelitis is so bad these days, the movie listings read like baseball scores. Later this season, CBS is presenting a miniseries called Scarlet, proving that the leading lady of Gone with the Wind was right when she said that tomorrow is another day. Hitchcock has already been sequelized once by Showtime, in a 1990 telemovie called Psycho 4, The Beginning. But that one starred Tony Perkins and provided childhood flashbacks of Norman Bates, and it wasn't bad. The Birds, too, is bad. How bad? Here's a hint. The direction credit on Birds 2 goes to Alan Smithy. Alan Smithy is the fake name directors use when they don't want their real names associated with a project. Rick Rosenthal is the guy who doesn't want to be associated with Birds 2, and anyone who sees it will understand why. Tippi Hedren is back, but only in a brief cameo and playing another character. Instead of real stars this time, we have Chelsea Field and Brad Johnson, who are so dull they're outacted by a swarm of seagulls. Where Hitchcock's film had artistry and suspense, Birds 2 has blood and stupidity. Wasting no time, the first attack comes even before the title credits, and every attack is exactly the same. Lots of screaming, fluttering, tacky music, and bad special effects.
Oh my God!
My favorite part comes when the family gets into a small motorboat and tries to avoid an airborne seagull attack by flipping the boat over in the water and hiding underneath. At that point, I'm thinking, a little theme music from Jaws would have gone a long way. When your thoughts drift like that during what's supposed to be the film's climax, you know it's not a horror movie, it's a horrible movie. Hitchcock's movie had a lot of great touches, a very literal use of the bird's eye view, that great scene of crows gathering in the schoolyard, and the creepy ending when the survivors walked and drove away, leaving Bodega Bay to the birds. There are some great phrases for gatherings of specific types of birds, and some of them could have been written by Hitchcock himself. A squabble of seagulls, a murder of crows, an unkindness of ravens. But Birds 2, Land's End, belongs in a different category. If it flocked together with other movie birds of the same feather, it'd be a rafter of turkeys.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, Chris Fraley, and Audrey Voblaitis. Our program was directed today by Sue Spolin. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne Neville and Devin Reef are our interns. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, in anticipation of the Oscars, we reach into our archives for interviews with some of the great behind-the-camera talents. We'll hear from the inventor of the Steadicam, Garrett Brown, from bug wrangler David Brody, and sound designer Alan Splett. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.